Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a tobacco conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Tobacco, as in the natural plant that contains a well-known addictive chemical called nicotine. It seems like ancient history. It was only a few years ago that tobacco was part of everyday society. Everyone smoked. It helped people relax if stressed. Soldiers received boxes of cigarettes as part of their essential gear. Mental health patients received a box of cigarettes to help relax. 3 out of 4 doctors recommended Marlboro or whatever other brand of cigarettes, and Joe Camel made tobacco friendly for kids. And hey, no one died of tobacco. It took 100 years and 7,000 publications before cigarettes and tobacco were acknowledged as dangerous. It took a special box and a death certificate to prove that black lungs were caused by tobacco and not something else. Does any of this sound familiar to today's vaping or marijuana culture? It took a concerted campaign to make tobacco uncool. I recall the model and actress Brooke Shields saying, "It's like kissing an ashtray." It also took a few big, fat lawsuits against the tobacco industry. What can we learn from tobacco and apply it to today's marijuana culture? To learn more about the history of tobacco, I reached out to Professor Richard Daynard. Professor Richard Daynard is a legend in the lawsuits against big tobacco. He was at the forefront of the international movement to establish the legal consequences against the tobacco industry for tobacco-induced death, disease, and disability. He led the strategic effort that led to a $206 billion settlement against big tobacco. He is a legal scholar and president of the Northeastern University School of Law, Public Health Advocacy Institute in Boston. He chairs its Tobacco Products Liability Project and helped initiate a new Center for Public Health Litigation. He has numerous publications, awards, and speaking engagements. To learn more about Professor Richard Daynard, check out the High Truth show notes. Dr. Richard Daynard, welcome to High Truths.
Well, thank you. My pleasure to be here.
I am so excited that you're joining us. I said I get to speak to a legend, a real legend. And the reason that I wanted to reach out for you is that I always say that we have to learn from history, otherwise we're doomed to repeat it. And yet it seems like we don't really learn to history. So I'm reaching out to you. And first, let's get a little background. You are a professor of law, studied at Harvard. And what made you do that? Why did you grow up and say, hey, I want to be a lawyer one day?
Okay. I grew up in New York basically in a secular Jewish environment. And there were two things that was respectable for somebody to do when you got out of college. And I didn't really like blood. So all that was left was becoming a lawyer. And I did have there were other lawyers in my family. So it was a familiar thing to do. So I, after college, studied philosophy in college, then went to Harvard Law School, assuming I was going to become a practicing lawyer, whatever that was. I didn't have any very clear idea what that meant. I knew the one thing I wasn't going to be doing was having anything to do with lawsuits or litigation. That tells you what happens when the difference between what happens, what you think you're going to be doing in life and what you end up doing in life. But I go to Harvard Law School at that point, And to some extent, even today, Harvard Law School was basically a transmission belt for people to move on to Wall Street law firms. And, you know, from New York, that didn't sound so bad to me. So I worked for one over my second year, which was a typical thing to do. The law school is 3 years. And I worked for one, and it was a very pleasant experience. And, you know, I'm sitting in my, I'm thinking about what will I be? Sitting in my chair thinking when I'm 50, which of course at that point seemed, you know, almost unimaginably far ahead of in the future. When I'm 50, what will my life be like? Will I be a partner at a Wall Street law firm and, you know, have a wife and two kids, and in those days a station wagon, and live in the suburbs of New York, you know, the nicer, you know, up one of them, Scarsdale or whatever. And and then what about my, what will I be doing in my life? What will I have to say for myself? And I took from my experience in the summer, where one of our clients was Ford Motor Company. Remember, this was way back. This was, you know, we're talking 1966 at this point. And they had just built a new plant, and they had literally acres of linoleum, and it was peeling. So one of my assignments, I had all kinds of different assignments with different clients. One of my assignments was to help draft a legal complaint against a linoleum company so they could, you know, breach their warranty and so forth. And I did. So I thought back to that as sort of my typical experience. This would be, and I thought, what would I be doing? You know, I would be, is this a good thing or bad thing? Presumably it's a good thing to, you know, let people know that the law is going to be enforced, so you're a little more careful manufacturing things and so forth. And is that a good thing? Well, it oils the wheels of commerce, and presumably the wheels of commerce should be oiled. But then I thought, you know, I only got one of these things. And do I really want to spend it oiling the wheels of commerce? And my answer was no. I didn't know what I did want to do, but I knew I didn't want to do that. So that left me, sort of here I am in the third and final year of law school. And so I managed to get a very nice clerkship for a very good judge. And that puts it off a year. And then the next year, I was a teaching fellow at Columbia, and I figured I was going to get maybe sociology would be interested. So I was going to get a PhD in sociology. And that was sort of interesting. But as long as I was there, I got on the market for a, you know, tenure track position and got an offer from Northeastern, which I took. So I came up from New York to Boston. And and I couldn't keep going to Columbia. So, but my favorite professor, Herb Gans, was just moving from Columbia to MIT for a new urban studies and planning program. So he said, why don't you come join us? So I took a terminal sociology degree, a terminal master's degree at Columbia, and went on, got a PhD while I was teaching at Northeastern, got a PhD in urban studies and planning. So, you know, there I am, okay, and I'm teaching at law school, started teaching at law school in 1969. I'm sort of settling in at this point. And it must have been 15 years later, I've been teaching this course inspired by my planning degree called Consumer Protection Planning. I was always interested in consumer protections. And I was always puzzled. I was particularly interested in cigarettes, negatively interested in cigarettes. Cigarettes is a consumer product, because this is a product that killed more people than all other consumer products combined.
Did you know you knew that at the time?
Did I know that at the time? I'm not sure I knew the numbers, but I did know that it was, you know, the 1954 was when, no, 1950 was when the Reader's Digest, which was the most read periodical in America at the time, and they began a series of articles based on studies that had been published on in England, I think it was, on the relationship between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. So it was pretty well established. It was pretty clear that smoking caused lung cancer. Now, obviously, the tobacco industry was and continued for another 3 decades or so to vigorously dispute this, because the disinformation, one of their internal documents says our product is doubt. You know, that's what we're doing. We want to, if we can confuse people and they're hooked on cigarettes, they'll keep smoking. If, you know, they really, you know, have to understand that it really does cause lung cancer, then maybe they'll make a bigger effort to quit smoking, and more of them will succeed in doing so.
And this was 1960s. That was the peak of cigarette smoking in the United States, right? And were you ever a smoker, your family?
No, I wasn't a smoker. My parents didn't smoke. You know, I had smoked. I had, with my friends, I had snuck a pack. We found a pack of cigarettes on the street when I was living in the Bronx, where I lived till I was 10. We found a pack of cigarettes, and we went up to my room and lit them up. We were probably 8 or 9 years old, and the housekeeper, you know, smelled them, and she said, if I put them out and throw them out, she won't tell my parents. And, you know, that was my first smoking experience. Then next time was probably on an airline. You would be flying somewhere, and the, you know, very attractive flight attendant would come up and offer you, you know, some cigarettes. Which kind would you like? You know, and so I probably smoked a couple more there. But the answer is I smoked very few cigarettes in my life and never liked it. Now, one of the, you know, as you know, with nicotine addiction and with cigarettes, it ain't fun for anybody at the beginning in terms of the product. You cough, it's aversive. But if you have social support to continue to do it, and all these ads, you know, showing, you know, what a cool person you're going to be, cool and attractive and so forth, that, you know, you're motivated to go on. Well, you know, I wasn't motivated to go on, so I didn't. But where my interaction with cigarettes was, and that came from an early age, was beginning in my early teens. I was what's called a radio ham, an amateur radio operator. And we would have meetings once a month. And when I moved to Manhattan at age 10, there were meetings at the back room of Forrester's Bar and Grill on East 84th Street. And I would go there, and people would be smoking in the room. And I didn't like it. I mean, I knew it was, you know, I didn't know any of the, I mean, there was, at that point, no knowledge about the dangers of secondhand smoke. The evidence that secondhand smoke causes lung cancer really didn't come out till about 1980. But so I didn't know, you know, I didn't have any kind of clinical notion or epidemiological notion. Of course, I didn't know those words, but I did know this stuff was bad. You know, you breathe it in, and it was, you know, it wasn't doing nice things to my lungs or my nose and so forth and so on. So I would, you know, I would have to dip out from the meeting room in the back to the bar to actually get some fresh air. You can imagine how bad it was in there. So I always thought that this was a bad thing. There was something wrong, that when if you're polluting an environment and people are objecting, you know, I always, my sense of justice, you know, was that, you know, what's right and wrong was that, wait a second, the people who are, you know, involuntarily exposed are the ones who should be protected. And the people who are doing it, aside from any other thing it might be doing to them, they ought to just stop, you know, while they're. But that was my perception. That wasn't anybody else's perception, certainly not in that room and not generally in society at that point. And
I saw that when you were teaching, there was a YouTube video celebrating your 50-year career, and you're saying that there were kids in the class who would light up, and you would tell them to put it out.
Well, I didn't. I'm not sure there were kids lighting up in the classroom. I'm trying to recall. There were certainly colleagues. I mean, I certainly had this in faculty meetings. This I do remember, that in faculty meetings, colleagues would light up. They'd light up cigarettes. They'd light up pipes. That was normal. I asked them to stop. You know, finally, I walked out. The dean's office.
I imagine that was not politically correct to ask people to take out, you know, to put their cigarettes out. It's like, hey, I'm in the lounge. This is what I, who are you to tell me this?
Yeah, no, this wasn't even a lounge. This was a faculty meeting in the dean's office. And we were a small number of faculty, so we could all squeeze in there. But yeah, I walked out and, you know, okay, I get it. Somebody came out and said, you can come back in. We stopped smoking, or whoever it was stopped smoking. But clearly, yeah, clearly considerable bouts of resentment. You know, who was this, you know? And I was very young. I was younger than all the rest of them. So, I started teaching when I was 25. I was hired when I was 25, started when I was teaching when I was 26. And, you know, they were older. They weren't very old, but they were older than me. So what the heck is this, you know, pitcher, this young kid telling us what to do? They didn't like it, but, yeah, I had, by the time I was 30, I had tenure. And, you know, nobody could, you know, they didn't like it, but, you know, I could take it. But yes, there was no question. I had no social support from even from the non-smokers in the room, who just thought, you know, I should man up and take it, you know, but I didn't. Yeah, that's right.
That's interesting. And the other thing I wanted to ask you about your younger days at Harvard Law, another legendary professor from there is Alan Dershowitz. Did you run in contact with him?
Yes. In fact, I contacted him when he and I were both going to our first day of class at Harvard Law School. He was teaching a course called Torts, and I was teaching, and I was a student. And we happened to be walking together, and we introduced ourselves to each other. And then when I sat down, the very first student he called on in his teaching career was, Mr. Daynard. So, and then I had worked with him on trying to recall, I think I worked with him on, and I don't recall the exact role he played, but he was helpful at least in some of our early tobacco cases. I don't recall exactly in what context.
Oh, interesting. Well, you both have the same kind of feistiness, I think, and similar backgrounds. So that's why I brought that up. So you decided that you're going to go after the tobacco company. You were the David, they were the Goliath. And I guess if you could stand up to your older professors and tell them to take out their cigarettes at faculty meeting, you had no qualms about going after big tobacco.
No. It's interesting. So I'm teaching this class called Consumer Protection Planning. And at that point, I had become president of a group called GASP, Group Against Smoking Pollution of Massachusetts, the focus being on secondhand smoke. But we were also, beginning to... We were all aware of the evidence of the harm it's causing to smokers. So that was something we were thinking about, too. And I tell the students I'm doing this. I always began the class by saying, if you're running a consumer protection agency, public agency, or a nonprofit advocacy organization, what do you do? So I said the same question, and these are law students. So they said, of course, you sue the bastards. They were more polite than that, but and I thought, yeah, that's right. So I set up, along with somebody I met at a concert who was a physician, but he was a former Nader's Raider, somebody who worked with Ralph Nader, who was the pioneering consumer protection person several years before that. And we got the idea together of setting up a tobacco products liability project. And we announced it, and we... had our first conference on the 21st anniversary of the first Surgeon General's report, I think. Yes, first Surgeon General's report on smoking was 1964. And this was on January 7th, 1985. It was the 21st anniversary. We had this conference, and we set this thing up, and some people heard there was a funding organization heard about the Rockefeller Family Fund. These were the grandchildren of the next generation down, and they were sort of a bunch of 60s types. And they thought, they checked out who's taking on the tobacco industry. Is anybody encouraging lawsuits against the tobacco industry? And they found out I was, so they offered me enough money to support our organization that we could hire an executive director and actually get the thing going. And we did. And that was, that got it going. And then there was a lawsuit that was proceeding, and the New York Times wanted to write up something about it. And they were told that I'm the one to talk to. So they talked to me. So there was a story that appeared in the New York Times, and I became the go-to guy, and we became the go-to organization for anybody interested in, either getting involved in suing tobacco companies or writing about it as a journalist.
Wow, that's great. So you took the media upstroke, the legal approach, and then are there many different lawyers, or did you get them all together under the same umbrella?
Well, we got them all together. They all came together beginning in that first meeting. We had another 20 some odd annual meetings after that. But the first meeting, there were a few lawyers who had filed lawsuits. They hadn't met each other. This was an occasion for them to talk with each other. And we brought in, some experts, because they were public health people, who, when they heard about this, they said, hey, it's about time. And they got in touch with me. And so it was an interesting meeting. And then as the additional meetings happened, there were more and more of them. And of course, the tobacco companies were all getting together. Told the court that they had a joint defense, which meant that they could all sit around in the court staring at the plaintiff's witnesses and, trying to make them uncomfortable. But the plaintiff's lawyers hadn't gotten together. So now we were getting together. We were evening the playing field. I began publishing something called the Tobacco Products Litigation Reporter, which was, in those days, at this point, I stopped after 25 years of publication. I said, Gutenberg, has had a very good run for his money, but print media is really not the thing anymore. You don't need it to find out what the cases are. But back then you did. Back in 1984, you didn't have, you couldn't just go to your computer, say, tobacco litigation, lawsuit, enter, and have it all pop up. So we published this, and it was, this was important, resource and so forth.
When you started, did you go after one company at a time? Like, okay, we're going to go after Marlboro, or we're going to go after Camel, or did you right away say we're going after all of them?
Well, it was the industry. They were really indistinguishable in their behavior. They were distinguishable in their particular marketing campaign. So, Philip Morris had the Marlboro campaign and the Cowboy. I don't know how old your audience is. You have to be pretty old to remember this. But, it was the Cowboy. And why the Cowboy? Because that's independence. The Cowboy is somebody who thinks for himself, chooses for himself, and goes out there. And then they were having the problems with himself, a part of this thing. So they came out with Virginia Slims. You've come a long way, baby. Hey, here's women's liberation. You can smoke like just like a man. There's no reason why, because in those days, a lot more men were smoking than women. It was considered not done, for women to smoke. Obviously, some were doing it, but Philip Morris figured out how do you break through that, that social psychological barrier.
They got the women demographic. They got the men.
Yeah. And the women actually weren't smoking Virginia Slims by and large. They were smoking Marlboros once they started. But the Virginia Slim campaign was mostly a campaign, though there was a product called Virginia Slims. It was mostly a campaign to get women to smoke Marlboros, which was their big product. And then, of course, a little later on, again, folks may remember the Joe Camel campaign, which was, I'm trying to remember the years on that. And that was a campaign to, convince people Camel had been, really an old man cigarette. At that point there were, Marlboro, anybody who was cool was smoking Marlboro. And so Camel had to figure out, how do we get the next generation? So they had Joe Camel, and Joe Camel was a cartoon camel, and he was a very, very cool camel, a very cool camel. He did all kinds of cool things on the beach and so forth and so on. And all the girls really admired Joe Camel. So how do you get the kids in there? But the companies were all the same. In other words, in terms of what their ultimate strategy was, they would have different campaigns at different times. But
and public health wise, they also said nobody dies from one smoke. They completely dismissed the fact that anybody dies from tobacco.
Well, it's certainly true that nobody dies from one smoke. One puff. That is true.
Yeah.
They also knew that it was highly addictive. And we have all kinds of, documents, internal documents. Once the cases began to be brought, this process in American law called discovery, where you're able to get documents, internal documents from the other side. And one of the documents said, fortunately, where this is a product that people really can't put down, once they start, they're really, hooked on it. And so they well understood the addictiveness. They fine-tuned the addictiveness to all kinds of documents about how they did it. It actually began even before they maybe were even articulating this to themselves, because cigarettes in the 19th century were a rarity. They were mostly hand-rolled, though, machines for making them were developed in the 1880s, but they were still, largely hand-rolled. They were smoked by women, and daring women occasionally would smoke one of them, but they wouldn't get hooked because of the pH, of the tobacco. The tobacco, if you cured normally, the way it was normally cured, if you smoked it, you couldn't really breathe it in. It was too harsh. So what they had done, even by the time that Camel came out, Camel was the first mass-produced, mass-marketed product in 1913. They had a great mass-marketing campaign. It was extremely successful. But the Camels, these cigarettes had was something we'll call flue-cured, which changed the pH, made them inhalable, made them not this irritating, highly irritating thing that kept you from taking it in. And once you inhaled it and kept it in your lungs for a couple of seconds, you were much more likely to become addicted and flow through your bloodstream, the nicotine flow through your bloodstream.
So they improved the delivery system.
Right. So it was a delivery system, but obviously they didn't have the scientific sophistication. They just knew that if you did this to the tobacco, then people would breathe it in and they would smoke it. But by the 50s, 60s, 70s, they knew exactly what they were dealing with, and there were all kinds of documents about their fine-tuning the addictiveness. You have to have, the level of nicotine has to be no less than X to, get the people addicted and keep them addicts coming back, and no more than Y, because you made it too high, the stuff was, just made you sick right away, as opposed to 30 years later with your lung cancer right away throwing up. You don't want to do that because you're not going to buy another pack, if that happens.
As a physician who studied people who died from prescriptions, I noticed medical examiner reports has, many of them have a little box that says tobacco use, yes or no, after you died. And I imagine that was And people will say it's just historical thing. It's like, oh, yeah, years ago this was put on there. And I imagine years ago people would dispute the fact that someone died of lung cancer and it was institutionalized to put in this was a tobacco or not tobacco. I don't know if you remember that historically.
I would hope medical examiners after the 1950s, because by... the first Surgeon General's report, as I said, was 1964. Surgeon General's reports are consensus documents. You know, it's not just the Surgeon General sitting there saying, what do I think about this? It's a consensus of, you know, whoever is respected in the field.
7,000 articles, right? Or 6,000 publications, something like that.
At that point, there are many more than that since then. But there was no doubt among anybody who wasn't in there to prove the contrary. And there were two groups of folks like that. There was the tobacco industry that obviously, to the extent they could confuse people, that was critical to maintaining their sales. And then there would be addicted, you know, people, including addicted doctors, who didn't want to think. There's a process, psychological process called cognitive dissonance. And they know that, well, I'm a very smart person. I'm scientific. I follow the data and I'm smoking. So there must be a good reason why I'm smoking. This data must really not be convincing. There must be a hole in it and so forth. And that's normal cognitive dissonance working. So there were some doctors in good faith, certainly in the 50s and early 60s, who were like that. By the time the lawsuits come up, the tobacco companies are still in the lawsuits in the 1980s. The tobacco companies still had some of these doctors. At that point, they weren't no longer in good faith. They were on the tobacco industry payroll. It was perfectly clear why they continued to, quote, believe what they were saying if they did. There was very good money in it for them. But they were in there saying, you know, in the famous Cipollone case in the late 1980s, they had a couple of doctors coming in and saying, no, it doesn't cause lung cancer. There was one doctor who had done, experiments with, dogs, I think, whatever, and said, you know, we have these dogs smoking and none of them have gotten lung cancer. Well, they weren't addicted to, they weren't smoking at the same. Anyway, but you had, I mean, that was actually the kind of testimony they were making. They stopped that after a while because, you know, the jurors eventually, you know, all of the jurors accepted that smoking, the principle that smoking causes lung cancer. So to have tobacco industry experts testifying to the contrary, you know, is like, as one of my law professors put it, it's like the 13th stroke of the clock. Not only is it obviously wrong in itself, but it casts doubt on the other 12. So if you have the tobacco industry today bringing an expert saying, I don't think smoking causes lung cancer, you'll say, well, not only is he lying, but probably the other people they're bringing in a line too. So they stopped doing that. But in individual cases today, in the year, you know, 2024, they will still have doctors coming in and saying, Jane Smith or Joe Jones, whoever the plaintiff or we call the decedent, the person who died, and other people, family then brings the case, the plaintiff or the decedent, their cancer wasn't caused by smoking. They still do that.
Right, right. And I imagine that's why they put that in the medical examiner's report. So it took you several years. How long was this process?
Well, you know, I would say the process, if I started in 1984, and this is the year 2024, so it's 60 years, it's still going. You know, the tobacco companies are still out there. They're still manufacturing these addictive and deadly products. So at some point or another, we still have work to do. And in fact, that the Public Health Advocacy Institute, which is what GASP sort of evolved into, which is a nonprofit, 501c3. But we've, for the last 10 years, we've had a nonprofit law firm called the Center for Public Health Litigation. And we've been bringing cases along with others and working with other attorneys to bring cases against the tobacco industry. So we're still doing it and they're still doing the denial. But when the first case, there were some cases before this Cipollone case, but the Cipollone case in, I think, 1987 was when it...
Which one was that? The
Cipollone was Rose Cipollone. It was in federal court in New Jersey, and the case went on for many, many months of testimony. Jury found for the plaintiffs, and the district court judge wrote a very powerful opinion that quoted from some of the documents. The case then gets reversed by the Court of Appeals that just sort of can't wrap their head around the notion that a cigarette is an unreasonably dangerous product. You know, they have all kinds of things that, you know, they know are, but cigarettes, you know, so they come up with some doctrine. You can make anything up as legal doctrine. Anybody who watches today's Supreme Court knows that you can make up anything you want to reach the result you want. You can, you know, make up any kind of doctrinal argument. You just tell your law clerks, go find me the best argument you can to support this conclusion. And off they go, and out it comes. But, in the end, we got the Supreme Court to essentially give the go-ahead to this kind of litigation. And that was in the early 1990s. And then the critical cases, well, we had, you know, some cases, but you didn't really have cases beginning to win and not be reversed till about 10 years after I started. And in fact, it was sufficiently lonely out there because legal scholars in general were also doing cognitive dissonance. These cases hadn't won in the past. There'd been a first wave of litigation in the 1950s and 60s through ending in the early 70s. And the case is all lost one way or the other, either before a jury or on appeal. So the scholars were all trying to explain, why did they lose? There must be a very good reason why they lost. And this must be
follow
very
the
good
money.
Reason.
Follow the money.
Why you can't possibly bring these cases. So that was the scholarly consensus when I got started. It was somewhat similar to my colleagues who were smoking in the dean's office, you know, in the faculty meeting. Yeah, well, we all know that there's no problem with smoking, and certainly no such a problem as secondhand smoke. And then similarly, you know, the scholars all knew that you couldn't do it. And it took about 10 years for people to actually do it. And at some point in the course of that, I actually sat down and said, okay, yeah, am I tracking? Am I reality testing? Am I the one who's crazy? Are they crazy, all crazy, or am I the one who's crazy? You know, I decided this is really a chair and this is really a table and so forth. And I'm tracking reality.
It's hard to be ahead of your time. It's hard. I mean, I've noticed that in my profession because when you're ahead of the curve, it's like you said, lonely and people don't believe you. And then, you know, years later, it's like, oh, I guess he was right.
Oh, no, more than that. Years later, everybody knew that.
Right.
You know, of course, everybody knows that. We always knew that, right? You know, right. You rewrite your.
But I don't know if everybody, the public doesn't know that, right? For me growing up, tobacco was, you know, was known to be a bad thing. But where I see where it's the history doesn't learn from itself is when opioid prescriptions came out.
Yeah.
Right. And I was a young doctor. And it's like, okay, this is what you're supposed to do. Don't judge someone else's pain. That's what my older, smarter doctor said. And I like, okay, doesn't make sense. I don't think so, but I'll do it because smarter doctors than me said to do that. And when I was one of the first to resist that trend, it was like, what are you talking about? You don't know what you're talking about. You're not an expert. You're not compassion, right? You're ahead of the curve. And now years later, it's like, oh yeah, thank you so much for what you did on opioid prescriptions, right?
Oh, right. So which is good, as opposed to saying, well, actually, I always knew I should. No, because again, it's cognitive dissonance. It takes a certain level of courage and willingness to admit you made a mistake. And not everybody is ever willing to admit they made a mistake. But yes, That's right. No, I remember getting my annual checkup at Mass General Hospital, and I go in and the, you know, nurse, whoever's taking, you know, my temperature and pulse and so forth, says, "And how is your pain?" And I said, "My what?" She said, "Your pain." I said, "I'm in here for a annual checkup. I'm not in any kind of pain. Well, what are you talking about?" She said, "Oh, didn't you know this is the fifth or sixth or whatever, what number?"
The fifth vital sign, which really pissed me off as a doctor, because at the same time the O2 sat probe came out, which is your oxygen, at the same time about that the vital sign came out. And I was like, how did it jump the gun? It could be, I mean, make it the sixth vital sign. Why did it become more important than your oxygen level, right?
and the answer is because these guys, this was, our friends, what is the name of the company?
Purdue.
The
Sacklers.
Right. Sacklers, they were very similar to tobacco executives. Yeah. And they understood that what you had to do was you had to, get practitioners, you had to get the leaders in the field, bring them to conferences, you pay people to give, talks and so forth. You do have it in very nice places. Unfortunately, the conference has to be on some Caribbean island, but, we don't want this to have to be any expense. So we will pay your expense, doctor, to fly in, even the people, and participate in this. And by the way, there's a very nice golf course connected here and so forth and so on. And they basically got the critical, the people who, the powers that be, in the...
the influencers. They got the influencers and they got the rest of the...
Right. They didn't call them influencers back then, but precisely. Yeah, that's right. And there it was. If I had said I was in any pain... No, actually, for a while, I threw them out. It's too bad. I could have made a lot of money on the street with them. But I had a number of prescriptions of oxycodone or oxy, whatever they are. I had prescriptions with 60. I may even have had one with 100 in it. And this would be for my dentist. You came back and
We were lied to. We were told nobody gets addicted if they have real pain. Only people who are addicts get addicted. But if you really have pain, from your tooth, then you won't get. That's what we were told.
And you also can't get it. You're also not going to get addicted because, unlike this is a single slow release thing as opposed to, a big hit. So you can't get addicted from that. Of course, the moment you get addicted, you discover that if you chop on it, you can then take the whole thing.
Yeah. And it was a complete, lie, I guess, because you would say nobody got addicted.
That's the word, lie.
It's a lie. That's what you say. And now we know 100% of people get addicted. 100%. If you take it long enough, you will be addicted. I mean, luckily we have treatment for that now.
It's interesting. I'm surprised at the 100% because the story with cigarette smoking is there was always a group of people and it eventually got known as chippers, picking up something from the drug, the drug world, apparently. And there were always some people who could take it or leave it. If it was Saturday night and their friends were smoking, they could smoke a couple of cigarettes and then not do it. I mean, I believe the susceptibility to addiction, like most other natural phenomena, are in a bell curve.
I think that's the susceptibility, but so it's a different concept. If you took that nicotine every single day, right? You're talking about the people who like, I don't like it that much, so I'm not going to do it.
No, or people who I can take it or leave it.
Right, but if you were going to take nicotine all the time. You will be addicted and you'll withdraw, right? And the same thing with opioids. If you're going
to do it. It's the same thing. It's going to happen to your brain, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you become, dependent. And then they would make different names. Oh, you're not dependent. I'm only, I'm dependent, not addicted. And they created a new vocabulary even for the medical field to deny that. And what I ended up doing is studying every single person who died. That's how I noticed the tobacco. The thing on the medical examiner reports, but I looked at every prescription, anybody who died of a medication, all of them, all 250 in San Diego, I looked at all their medications that they got before they died. And that, I called it the death diary research. That changed my life. And I thought, wow, this is, it doesn't matter. These people died. And then I'd go work in the emergency departments and I'd see their medication reports. And it's like, wow, you look just like the person I just saw at the morgue. Thought, you know, we
is that where you would like to be? Is that your next question you asked them?
No, but I mean, you can't say that, but I would just say, I'm really worried about you. Cause they were told, well, my doctor gives me this. It's like, I'm still worried about you. These combinations are deadly. You know, you have to be able to reach people, but, that was a big thing. So $206 billion. I imagine that was a big lawsuit.
That was filed in these were a series of lawsuits that were filed by the states in 1996, and they were suing on the basis of their own losses as states, because they had paid health care for employees. They were paying part of Medicaid as paid for by the state. And they said, we just want to get it back. And what the companies couldn't do is they couldn't blame them, because this is the other cute piece of it. And it's true, of course, with people who are addicted to opium, as it is with cigarette smokers, even more so with people who are addicted to opium. These are addicts. These are bad people. These are people who don't have self-control, and they are addicts. Yeah. And in the case of you know, drugs, you know, what do you do with addicts? You lock them up. You know, these are bad people. This didn't happen with the cigarette industry, perhaps for the simple reason that if you were to try to lock up all nicotine addicts, you know, you would have, you know, tens of millions, you know, something like not a majority, but, 40% of the American public, in prison for being nicotine addicts.
Yeah. I like that statistic, because even at the peak of smoking in the 60s, the maximum was less than 50%. It seemed like everybody around you were smoking and it was cool. And the advertisements told you and your faculty meetings showed you that everybody's smoking. But actually, the truth was, it's not the majority. The majority of people did not smoke.
And actually, in my faculty meetings, the majority weren't smoking, but the rest of them were grown-ups.
Yeah.
You know, somebody wants to exercise their choice to smoke, you shut your mouth.
So, right, which is the same thing that's happening today in various things. But $206 billion, is that enough of a deterrent? Or does it pay to lie about public health, make your money, and then, you know, deal with the lawsuits?
Well, it actually wasn't, but the... but other things came in, because they didn't have to pay the $206 billion at once. They were paying something like $8 billion a year this was a result of something known as there were two things. One, there was something called the Global Settlement, which required action by Congress, basically to protect the tobacco industry from further lawsuits. As you can imagine, I testified against that, and others did, and that didn't go through. The industry was first in favor of it, but then they took their lobbying funds that were going to be used to support it, and they switched them to oppose it after it began to have some real teeth in terms of restricting the behavior of the industry. But then they did this something called Master Settlement Agreement, and that's the one with the $206 billion, I think. But that's projected over 25 years, which is totally arbitrary, because this is, it's something like $7 or $8, $9 billion a year. It's based on a whole bunch of different statistics, so it varies year by year. But there is no, you know, end to it. But they just pick the number. They said, "Well, look at how much it is if you just add it all up, don't discount it, and over 25 years." And that was a big number. I mean, what it resulted in is the tobacco company. It didn't hurt the tobacco companies very much, because after all, they were an oligopoly. At the moment, there are only two of them, but back then, we've had so little antitrust protection in the United States in the last 60 years that they've been able to combine two, but it didn't really much matter. They were an oligopoly, so they all did things together. So you know, when Philip Morris raised their price, you know, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, all the other companies had raised their price similarly, and they raised it enough to recover what they were paying. Now, they made a little less profit, but they made less profit only because as the price went up, and it went up dramatically, people smoked less. It was harder to get kids to start smoking. It got too expensive. So it was harder to get kids to start smoking. There was more incentive for adults, particularly poorer adults, to do the or less affluent ones, the ones where the price actually mattered, reduce their consumption or try to quit and so forth. So it did hurt them that way, but they were making as much money on each pack of cigarettes as they had before the deal, even including having to pay this. They were just selling somewhat fewer packs. Probably equally important was the fact that the publicity around these companies had behaved very badly. They had lied. And then these documents I talked about earlier, these discovery documents, where the evidence of what the industry knew and what they did about it came out. And there are over 1,000 articles now based on these documents, some of them scholarly articles, some of them, you know, news articles and so forth, and a lot of news articles based on the scholarly articles and so forth. So that I think people are at this point are much more aware. I knew we had turned a corner in terms of delegitimizing not only the product, but the industry, because I used to do searches, very rudimentary online searches. I forget what I was using, but some early search engine. And I would do, you know, media and tobacco. And then I saw an article where some people were suing the chemical industry or some branch of the chemical industry about some particularly toxic chemical. And they said, these chemical executives are no better than tobacco executives. Okay, at that point, I don't know what the opposite of the gold standard is, whatever it is the lead standard or something worse. But whenever it is, once I realized the tobacco executives had gotten established in the public's mind.
They've been demonized. Big tobacco equals evil, right?
Yeah, evil doers, people who would, you know, risk the lives of their customers to make an extra buck.
Right. Profits over public health. That's kind of like...
Right. Profit over the health of their customers.
Yeah. Right. And so I get what I understand from you is that $206 billion, that the money is not a deterrent. So the tobacco playbook, that's another kind of like common word, right? Like instead of big tobacco, which is equal, the tobacco playbook is, you know, profits over public health. That's kind of been applied when we kind of touched about it to the opioid prescriptions. Like, okay, we're going to, you know, hide the truth, make it attractive. Everybody should use it. Let's, you know, pay our influencers, make it socially unacceptable to have pain. Pain should be a zero. I always tell people, if you want your pain to be zero, you could be dead or on a ventilator. You can't. It's not realistic.
Pain is how we go around in life. You know, one of the critical things we need to have ready to go. So if you know,
it's a protective track. It could be protective in a way.
You put your finger on a hot frying pan, you take it away, right?
Yeah.
That's pain that lets you do it, right?
Right. And so now I guess I just see history repeating itself, but even, you know, in a better way, right? We had big tobacco, but now big marijuana has learned, and some of the same people, some of the same executives doing the same thing, using the same playbook, but on steroids, right? I mean, you had Joe Camel, but now you've got like candies and sodas and all sorts of things. They've also adjusted, like you were talking about, like the nicotine level, like this is gonna get you addicted and this is too much and it tastes bad. They've, you know, played with that. They genetically modified the plants. They've got these vape oils and shatters that could be 90% THC. That's not at all what anybody voted for. Children The number one cause of pediatric overdoses in the emergency departments throughout the country now is THC, marijuana. I see the same playbook happen. I'm sure it's going to end up the same way. It'll be a big lawsuit. And that's probably in the calculation of big marijuana. It's like, okay, well, you know, so we'll get sued. But in the meantime, we're going to go and deny and dispute, because that was a good playbook for tobacco. And it seems to be working for vape products, marijuana. It worked for opiates. Opiates, I think, ended earlier because it's a prescription. There's FDA guidance. And so that was easier to contain that problem.
Legally, but you had all these people who are hooked on it who now had to go to the illegal market to get their, you know, get their necessary needed fix.
Right. But now we have treatment for that. So there's no need to go to the illegal. I mean, we have buprenorphine, we have medication, we've advanced in that. I mean, there's a small percentage the fact that we when we started this craze about really going after doctors, this is how I got involved. It's like, okay, I was the bad guy. I was a supply chain of these opioids that were addictive. So we manage that supply chain of the physicians, and we fix that. People are not really dying. It's not 100%, but people are not dying from our medications as much anymore. At that time, there were 100 deaths a year from people dying from drugs. Now we're at 300. Okay, so it's not the people who just didn't get their medications who are. This is a fentanyl. This is a whole nother crisis, but that's aside. That's a different playbook. That's international relations playbook, because that's coming from abroad. But within the United States, it is the biggest, you know, distributor, producer of you know, and commercialization of marijuana more than anyone. And I'm wondering, what can we learn?
At the moment we're in our house in Western Massachusetts, and we drive to a town called Great Barrington, and there's a circle in Great Barrington, and I think it's three of the buildings around the circle are marijuana dispensaries. The fourth one happens to be the police department, but since it's all legal, it's all there. But there's something like six or seven different dispensaries in this one. In this one town. So it's become, yes, this is, at least here in Massachusetts and in New York, went up to New York, and New York is looking the same. And so, yeah, that's it.
Right. And we think, okay, and I've even heard some young doctors, that cognitive dissonance that you're saying, oh, but this marijuana, this is healthier than tobacco. It's like, it's still secondhand smoke. You're still, you know, as far as me being around you, and it's still going in your lungs. That's not healthy. They've actually done studies on secondhand smoke of what's worse, a Marlboro cigarette or a blunt. And a blunt is 3.5 times more secondhand smoke effect than a marijuana cigarette. And yet, right now we're at the very, I think, I imagine at the early part of your career where it was not as socially acceptable to say that, like, this is not healthy for you.
Right. Yeah. I'm sure that's right. And the, you know, and the evidence is still in the early stages, because the widespread, you know, presumably.
But we actually have the research. We have thousands of articles on the harms, on the, like, not everybody who dies of tobacco gets lung cancer. Not everybody who uses marijuana gets emphysema or psychosis. It's actually worse. But we know that it's a risk factor. Nobody disputes the facts on tobacco anymore, but yet we actually have that data. It's just, I'm wondering if we need more of the lawsuits, and that your lawsuits gave a boost to public health, right? Like when you first came up to your, you know, public health experts, they were like, yes, thank you. Where have you been? I think that it's kind of, again, history repeating itself. You know, for the same kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is to make it parallel. I mean, my understanding, and I know very little about, you know, marijuana, other than the explosion of these, you know, marijuana dispensaries and so forth, but. It's less clear. You don't have a national advertising campaign for a particular, you know, chain of marijuana dispensaries. At least I'm not familiar with it. You don't have, hey, kid, you know, be cool, smoke a joint, whatever. At least I'm not seeing it, if we have that. So it's not, I'm not sure we have the, you would know better than I, is there a disinformation campaign going? Is there something like the Tobacco Institute, or they called it the Center for Tobacco Research, or the Tobacco Industry Research Committee in its earlier days? Oh, we're just doing neutral research. We just want to find the truth. They had in 1954, they had a full page ad in newspapers in every city of 50,000 or more. There were some like 300 some odd different ads run, full page ads, well, all the same ads, saying, called a frank statement to tobacco smokers, to cigarette smokers, saying, we hear these things, but that it might be dangerous, but we've other equally respected doctors say it isn't, and we are dedicated to finding out what the truth is. And as soon as we do, we'll let you know. Is there anything similar going on?
It sounds very much familiar. You're like, oh, whenever you hear it, how many times you've heard it? Oh, we just need more research. It's like, no, I can give you the research today on the harms. We don't need more research to tell you that it's bad for you. And or what makes marijuana interesting, it was similar to how opioids were, where it's like healthy, everybody should be using it, it's good for you, no one gets addicted. And it took a while to get the data out there. And here we actually have the data, but we have this huge public health misunderstanding. So people who are using are kind of like the faculty members in your early years who were like, this is fine, everybody's doing this, nobody says the bad things. The data was there because you knew the data, because you read those Reader Digest articles and you were aware, but your faculty member, that's not what they were. And that's, I think that's where we are today. The data is there. It's just being ignored, and the public is not making informed decisions, which they have the right to do.
Right.
Yeah. What would be your advice to lawyers now and that are starting to sue the cannabis industry? And I can imagine that it'll be for the magic mushrooms and the vapes and everything else that is misleading the public in terms of public health. There are suits against versus different companies. So I imagine the different tobacco industries. They're big chain marijuana distributors. There are claims first diagnosis, like you said, lung cancer, but there's also heart disease and, you know, mouth cancer and other things like that. And there's same thing with marijuana. There's pediatric poison, psychosis, lung disease, cancer. So how did you put that all together?
Well, you need to, I mean, there are different approaches. I mean, one approach, which theoretically should work, at least in some states, state law varies on this, is to say that the product is an unreasonably dangerous product. And that, but that's very hard with the states having taken active measures to legalize the sale. So you would then have to go on and say that the product at least should come with appropriate warnings, or that while there may be some kinds of marijuana products that are relatively innocuous, that the product that, you know, our client, you know, used, was sold by you, was not one of these relatively innocuous products. This was a more dangerous product, and you didn't alert the customer to the fact that it's more dangerous. Or maybe it's simply unreasonable for you to have sold a product that was that dangerous. Maybe just, you know, ordinary sort of THC, whatever. Maybe there's something there that, okay, it can, you know, have benefits and, you know, and harms and so forth, but not that big a deal. But you're also selling this other thing that's much more dangerous. You know, or should you, the seller, know or should have known that it was much more dangerous. You either shouldn't have been selling it at all. That's the notion of strict product liability, or you should have sold it with a very clear warning. That's the failure to warn. It's also related to strict product liability, or you affirmatively lied about it. Not only did you not give warnings, but you said, oh, no, this is just fine, kid, you know, or whatever. I guess they're theoretically they're not selling to children, but the at least not in the over the counter stores or whatever.
But they're what they're doing with the kids is they're making products that are very attractive. All the candies, all the various candies and gummies, and you know. That's how all the kids are getting it. They're not addicted. They're just like finding their parents' supply and putting it in their mouth because it looks like candy.
Right. Yeah. No, someone we know got very sick because she ate a candy that was had been left around. She was, you know, hungry. She had, so for this nice candy, she ate it and her son had left it, hanging around. But nothing. Yeah, it was just a day's discomfort. But I can imagine something much worse.
Yeah. I've had people. We come in. We do a whole stroke code. Someone says, "I'm not talking right. Something's wrong. I don't know what happened." And I'm like, oh, "I can't put you on a plane. You know, back from I'm in San Diego back to the East Coast." Without figuring it, why did the whole stroke study, and at the end, and several thousand dollars later of medical workups, he shows me the little, you know, candy that he took. It's like, oh, I just like your friend. I took this. I had the munchies. Could this be it? It's like, yeah, that could be it, which is good. Now you'll be okay, but you've warned. All right. So, learning from history, so you told us the various types of liability. I think it's just a matter of time. I think it took like 100 years for tobacco to change the culture. And I think the lawsuits help. I'm hoping it'll take us less for marijuana and the vapes and the other kind of things. But it seems like the tobacco playbook is, see if you agree, but the tobacco playbook is, you know, profits over public health. And continue full force, and getting sued is part of the calculation, but it still pays off.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, and it's not only it's obviously profits in front of ahead of public health and ahead of the health of specifically of their customers, and obviously all different pieces of that, the marketing campaigns, the disinformation campaigns. Both to the general public.
The confusion you were talking, you told us about how to confuse people is that's all part of it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, so that, you know, even if there's evidence out there about how dangerous it is or how dangerous particular products are, yeah, we'll make it sufficiently confusing. Yeah. And then we'll market the products in ways that are going to persuade people that it's safer. So filtered cigarettes, for example, were basically sold as a safer product. Light cigarettes, lower tar and nicotine. Yeah, they lower tar and nicotine on a cigarette machine, but cigarette machines don't compensate for the lowered nicotine by breathing it in deeper and holding it longer. Human beings do. They knew that. So there are all kinds of fraudulent techniques, just, you know, layers and layers and layers of them. And I'm sure the more we explore, you know, we examine at least parts of the marijuana industry or the legal drug industry, yeah, we're going to find similar things there. Because after all, it's making profits for the owners, for the company, the shareholders, whatever.
And Professor, your current public health institute is working on, did I see the gambling industry for gambling addiction?
Particularly online gambling. And we've started with online sports gambling because it turns out that online sports gambling is not, as I think the regulators and the general public thought, you know, just sort of taking, you know, what you could do at a racetrack, say, and bringing it on home. You know, you're going to bet on the result of the race. You're going to bet on who's going to win the game. No, what it's really based on is slot machine gambling, slot machine technology. And there was a pioneering study of that called Addiction by Design by a professor now at NYU, Natasha Dowshell. And she followed the gambling industry in Vegas, where she got there at a time where she watched the old roulette wheels and you know, 21, you know, gambling tables and so forth, going out the side door of the casinos and, you know, being chopped up for firewood. And in the door were coming slot machines, because slot machines had perfected the ability to addict people. So what's happening with online sports gambling and online gambling generally, obviously you don't even need to pretend if you have an online slot machine, you don't even have to pretend it's not a slot machine. But with online sports gambling, you're betting on how fast is the next pitch going to be? Is it going to be more or less than 90 miles an hour? Is it going to be a ball or is it going to be a strike? Is it going to be, you know, a walk or a hit? All of these things. And then, you know, if you're not getting enough action for that, you can bet on called a parlay. You can bet on six things at once. So the action continues. What is the action? This all has to do with, as you know better than I, it all has to do with, you know, getting the dopamine fired up in the brain, getting you basically hooked on these things. That has nothing to do with sports. Nobody walks into, you know, a baseball game thinking that the 37th pitch is going to be a ball or a strike. And I'm going to bet on that. That's not what gambling used to be. It's not what people thought gambling was. It's really a matter of getting you addicted to something that was very carefully designed to be addictive.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're just taking this from the slot machines from the originally in Vegas. And then, you know, of course, most states now, you know, have them, but then, you know, putting them online so that they could get people addicted to their, you know, yeah. You didn't have to go beyond your dining room table to be hooked and continue your addiction.
You're right. It's another addiction for profit industry.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Big time. Making big profits, and we're going to go after them hard.
Well, good. Well, good luck. And thank you so much, Professor Richard Daynard. Wow, what a privilege to be able to talk to you, chat with you, learn from you, learn from history. I wish we'd learn more from history so we don't keep repeating it. But hopefully we could take the not just the big tobacco playbook that the industry is looking, we could look at your playbook of fighting back and learning from that to protect the public.
I love it. Yep. Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.